기도로운.
Good evening, everybody.
Tonight,
I am going to talk about one of the most important topics in Buddhism, in the Dharma. I'm going to talk about karma. So in Zen, nothing is belief-based. Nothing is rule-bound. Nothing needs to be accepted beyond your experience. And karma is exactly in that category. There's a lot of misunderstandings of karma kind of in the popular usage. But karma in the Buddhist sense, the word literally means action. It also refers to actions and their results. And I'm going to say more about this later, but causes and effects, actions and results, are not two separate things. And they don't happen in two separate places. All of it takes place here. There's a way in which karma is, to speak of our karma or the karma we create, karma is a kind of behavioral conditioning. It's strengthening energies of wisdom or compassion, or strengthening the energy of grasping, aversion, and storytelling. This, and it creates kind of patterns which give rise to our mental formations. And this karma is, it's recorded, it's kind of kept track of in our bodies themselves, in our minds, in the universe itself, in the structure and patterns of our relationships. And so there's a way in which the kind of karmic universe is a closed system. No energy, no intention is ever lost. All of it is right here. And this is what we are talking about in the fifth of the five remembrances. My deeds are my closest companions. I am the beneficiary of my deeds. My deeds are the ground on which I stand. I haven't seen the Pali translation of the five remembrances, but I believe that word deeds is karma. My karma is my closest companion. You can never get away from it. All of it is right here. And one way of expressing the law of karma, the law of cause and effect, is that what you do matters. How you use your mind matters. What you do, the way you talk to yourself, the way you express your thoughts and words, and the actions that you do in the world matters. And so there's a way in the way that karma is our conditioning, the kind of habitual way we use our mind, the habitual way we use our language and we use our thoughts, it's as if it wears a groove in the mind stream, and then the slope pulls us in, and then we fall ever more easily into those three energies that create suffering: grasping, aversion, and delusion, or greed, anger, and ignorance. Part of what Zazen is it's kind of throwing some dirt back into that groove, kind of enabling us to have some space to kind of pop back out of it. And the first step to popping out of that groove is to notice, I seem to have slid down into this familiar terrain of storytelling or something. One of the other practices I sometimes talk about is Tonglen. Tonglen is a loving-kindness compassion practice, which I could say a lot more about, but in its kind of most succinct form, it's a kind of energetic imagining of breathing in of all of the suffering around you, of specific beings, of the world in general, and breathing out all such peace of mind as you have, all compassion, all everything you have as giving it away, and breathing out this loving kindness. And this practice is it's kind of an antidote practice to the kind of grasping and aversion that we normally practice. And so there's a way that if our mind is a hand, and we talk about opening the hand of thought, grasping and aversion is a clenched fist. And part of what Tong Wen is kind of stretching it backwards. So it's kind of creating the opposite energy so that we're able to kind of rest in the equanimity of... That isn't limited to our karmic conditioning. And this practice of Zazen, all of the practices of the Buddha Dharma are essentially enabling us to be more choicefully present for our life, to be able to show up and intimately inhabit each moment of our life, to be able to be free to choose, to not be bound by the shackles of our own mind. So in our liturgy, the first place that we encounter the word karma is in the piece that we begin every liturgical thing with, which is the Gatha of Atonement. Gatha is just a short chant. And we say, all evil karma ever committed by me since of old. And this word evil is provocative. We all have kind of reactions and ideas around it, and it's kind of chosen advisedly, although it can also be translated as or interpreted as harming karma, karma that causes suffering to oneself and others, or unwholesome karma, as opposed to wholesome karma, which is the way good is sometimes translated. But we use the word evil, and part of what this reminds us of is that all that there isn't some epic other thing, some kind of fantasy grade, you know, thing out there that is evil. All evil is small. All evil, even big evil, arises out of the energies of grasping, aversion, and certainty. Believing you're right, believing that you alone see the truth. This is the root of evil, and there isn't some other thing other than that, which is the way harm happens. And so we use this word evil. One of the things that kind of dawned on me a whole bunch of years into my Dharma practice is I had an image of myself as like the way I move through my life as like stomping through people's carefully manicured gardens in huge work boots, you know, and just carelessly inattentive, just attending to my own wants and everything like that, and coming and just kind of clomping through there. And that was for me kind of an expression of my own unwholesome karma, my own kind of karmic evil. And also this word evil brings with it all of these judgments, and we invite all of those in. An essential part of Dharma practice is what we're starting with here, with atonement, being at one with this evil karma, which is acknowledging the reality of our past actions, acknowledging the reality of our conditioning, acknowledging the reality of all of the suffering elsewhere in the world, and taking responsibility for it. And we say beginningless evil karma, and that we have created since of old. This karma is older than what we've done this week, since our birth. There's a way in which karma is the kind of energy of interactional patterns that's handed down in families. There's a way where all of that is our karma. Culture, our cultural beliefs, the kind of the memes and mores of our culture is a kind of karma that we are heir to, karma that we need to take responsibility for. It's genetic, it's evolutionary. There's a kind of there's a karma, the kind of karmic reaction we have of fearing pain, of trying to push away pain. Part of that is the evolutionary conditioning, which makes a lot of sense for one sphere of the world. And that is also, that very mechanism is the way that we create suffering for ourselves, by pushing away the things that we can't push away, that aren't in the category of things that can move. And there's no escaping karma. When our Sangha mate Edward was here, he told a story, which is from the Mahayana Sutras, that in one of the Buddha's previous lifetimes, and all of these things like previous lifetimes don't actually come with the kind of belief set behind them. It's a way of you can take it metaphorically. It's also more than that, but for our purposes, we can just take it as a story. In one of the Buddha's previous lifetimes, he was a pirate captain on a pirate ship, and the group of thieves went out with the intention of, you know, amassing a great deal of treasure, which they did, and they took it on board, and one of the thieves, one of the sailors, he decided that he was going to kill all of the other people and take all the more shares for himself. And the Buddha in this lifetime happened to be clairvoyant, and he saw this. He saw this intention arise in this person, and his response was to kill him. He killed the person who was going to kill those 500 people. And as a result of that karma, the Buddha was reborn in hell, reborn in the suffering realms. So part of what that means. Why was this a compassionate act for the Buddha? Because he recognized that this person intent on committing these vast murders, that was going to create a great deal of harming karma for that being, and the Buddha didn't want that to happen. And so he was willing to take that harming karma on himself, because killing him still creates harming karma. There's no escaping. But he was willing to take it, and then work with the suffering, work with the proximal causes of suffering, to continue to work to serve and save all beings. There's no escaping karma. So on the one hand, there's the teaching that it's your intention alone that matters. And this is one of the important teachings of Buddhism. So we have this kind of haughty language of saving all beings throughout space and time, but in a way that just refers to kind of raising the aspiration. And everything we do, we can't know how it's going to turn out. I mean, we so often think we do. We so often think we're just sure about the way it's going to work out. But if we look at our kind of our own batting record of predicting the future, it's really quite low. But what we can control is the attitude, the intention with which we do whatever we do. One of my favorite stories in Buddhism, and then that points to the kind of equanimity that's available when we really acknowledge the kind of full extent of our not knowing is this. Many years ago in ancient China, in a small rural village, an old farmer and his family had a beautiful stallion. This horse was their pride and joy. They used it to plow their fields and to pull the cart to take their vegetables to market. At the end of each day, their only son would groom the horse and tell it how wonderful it was. One day, the gate was left open by a visitor, and that night the horse ran away off into the wild hills around their farm. The old farmer's family was devastated, weeping and crying. The neighbors from the village all gathered round and said, "How terrible, what bad luck." The wise old farmer smiled simply and said, "Good, bad, who can say?" A few nights later, the stallion returned, bringing with him several fine young mares, which he had found running wild in the hill. Once again, all the neighbors gathered around him, saying, "How fortunate, how the gods must favor you. What a good thing to happen." The old farmer nodded simply and said, "Good, bad, who can say?" A few weeks later, their only son was trying to tame the new horse and was thrown and broke his leg so badly that he would never be able to walk properly again. The neighbors gathered around and said, "How terrible, your only son now unable to walk properly. What bad luck." The old farmer nodded simply and said, "Good, bad, who can say?" A few weeks later, the local warlord thundered into their village and demanded that all the able-bodied young men join his army to fight in a war far away. None of them ever returned. The old farmer's son was spared because he could no longer walk without a cane. Good, bad, who can say? There's a great amount of kind of freedom and comfort to when we kind of set down the burden of continually judging good and bad, continually trying to make things conform with our beliefs, conform to our certainties. When we recognize that that's just something that minds do, without identifying, without standing behind all of those judgments, which inevitably arise, then there's a freedom to encounter the world just as it is. So, one way of talking about karma that is often expressed in the Tibetan Buddhist teachings, they talk about the causes and conditions. So everything happens because of causes and conditions. Nothing is this way for no reason. It got here. How did it happen this way? Why is that person like that? Why am I like this? Well, there are reasons. And you know, if we looked carefully and in a certain kind of way, we could perhaps uncover specifically what those causes and conditions are. But in a way, those specifics are not what Dharma practice is about. Though there can be a lot of valuable insights that arise from those. You can learn a lot about yourself, about family patterns, about social systems. But there's a way in which being able to recognize that things happen because of causes and conditions, because of karma, because in a non kind of fatalistic way. So there's that kind of, we all come by our shortcomings honestly. We come by our suffering causing patterns, our unwholesome karma, our just screwing up repeatedly. We come by that honestly. And being able to just recognize that there are causes and conditions that led to this. There's another way in which that can start to be freeing, can start to kind of give you some more compassionate spaciousness. And other people too, even people who do things that we abhor and detest. There's a way in which everybody, even the people who we are sure are exemplars of evil, are in a important way doing the best they can with what they've got, with that karma of causes and conditions, the aggregate of things that went into this person being that bringing this to here. That's what comes forth. Now, part of what atonement is taking responsibility for it and aspiring, vowing to free ourselves from it, and then we inevitably fall back into it, and we vow, we aspire to free ourselves again, to be increasingly choicefully present. But the reason that we're even in a position to vow to practice being choicefully present is because of causes and conditions. There are always one way of looking at all things that happen is that there are proximal and distal causes. We look at the distal cause, and the distal cause appears to be that thing out there, that person out there, that circumstance out there. And the proximal cause is always something in us. It's always, and the proximal cause of suffering is always going to be a form of grasping or aversion or ignorance. The proximal cause is a really deep set belief, perhaps, that things should go our way, that that we want this experience away from us. And working with that, noticing when we're engaged in grasping or aversion, and just simply returning to the kind of intimate accepting practice of allowing things to be exactly as they are, that in a way purifies the proximal cause of suffering. And none of this is to say that, you know, it's all good, do whatever you want, lop off people's heads. You know, there's a way in which in samurai Japan that the teachings of Buddhism were corrupted into exactly that you can go out and, you know, express your warrior nature, and as long as you're just really honestly being there, then that's perfect just as it is. And there's a way in which that's true, but there's a way in which that's kind of the unimportant half of the story. And this is why the guidelines that are the precepts kind of flesh out that other side for us. And so working with these proximal causes, with our own grasping and aversion and ignorance in response to everything, in response to each situation, is why Dharma practice is really actually kind of small and inward and intimate. There's one Zen sutra that says practicing this way, we should function secretly like a fool, like an idiot. And this is also what in the chant that we did tonight, Tori Zenji's Bodhisattva's vow. This is what we're talking about in working with these proximal causes. So even though someone may be a fool, speaking ill of us and treating us bitterly, it's best to bow down. This is the Buddha appearing to us, finding ways to free us from our own attachments, the very ones that have made us suffer again and again and again. Now, first of all, I want to say that this bowing down is bowing down to the proximal cause. This isn't a practice of being a doormat and, you know, letting people run roughshod all over you. And sometimes from a position of being choicefully present, of being able to make a choice, the choice that we make is to express, we know this is unacceptable. We need to work with this differently. But so whenever so how is it the Buddha appearing to us? Whenever there's somebody speaking ill of us or treating us bitterly, for instance, so someone concretely doing something bad toward us, the choice there is to receive that moment just as it is, and to see the ways in which we are requiting that anger, we're returning that anger, we are engaging in more kind of unwholesome, suffering-causing anger or aversion karma of our own, or kind of receiving that moment as it is. And another story that goes along with this that I previously had mistakenly attributed to Hakuin, which is not. It's called "Is That So?" So the line in the story that's translated "Is that so?" is Japanese for "so desu ka?" And it isn't in Japanese. It isn't as kind of haughty and wry as it could be in English. It's more like, well then, let's see how that is. So, there was a Zen master who was praised by his neighbors as one living a pure life. A beautiful Japanese girl whose parents owned a food store lived near him. Suddenly, without any warning, her parents discovered she was with child. This made her parents angry. She would not confess who the father was, but after much harassment, she named the local priest. In great anger, the parents went to the master and said, "Is that so?" was all he would say. After the child was born, it was brought to the Zen master. By this time, he had lost his reputation, which troubled him and did not. But he took very good care of the child. He obtained milk from the neighbors and everything else he needed. A year later, the girl mother could stand it no longer. She told her parents the truth. The real father of the child was a young man who worked in the fish market. The mother and the father of the girl at once went to Hakuin to ask forgiveness, to apologize at length, and to get the child back. The priest was willing. In yielding up the child in great sadness, he said, "Is that so?" So, this also kind of points a one of the other themes of the story is that he's not like whatever, and he just leaves the baby on his doorstep and then goes about reading his paper or whatever. He cares for this child as if it were his own. And it's not that he doesn't care about his reputation. Presumably he was devastated and there were much painful consequences and there were probably feelings of humiliation that arose in his mind. But he was able to recognize those things as mental formations and do what needed to be done, which at one point was caring for the baby and at another point was giving it up. And feeling the sadness that any of us would, and perhaps some relief. So there's a and this is in "Is That So?" is also a expression of not knowing, of the giving up fixed ideas about ourselves and the universe. There's a Tibetan teacher named Lama Zopa who in a chapter in in a book called How to Be Happy, in the chapter called Compassion for the Enemy, says there is no harm to oneself that doesn't come from one's own mind. And this also points to those proximal causes of suffering, the suffering that is always present in proximal cause. And he says, when there is no anger inside, there is no enemy outside. And then he gives a different kind of frame for seeing someone who dislikes you or treats you bitterly. When someone dislikes you or treats you bitterly, when someone appears to you as an enemy, you have the wonderful opportunity to practice patience, and in that way develop your mind in the path of wisdom and compassion. Without the existence of someone who shows anger and dislike towards you, you have no such opportunity. If this person loved you, if this person only treated you just the way you wanted to be treated all the time, you would have no opportunity to develop patience, to cultivate a mind that cherishes other and truly brings happiness to all beings. This person who doesn't love you is the only one who allows you to practice patience and brings you all these infinite benefits, since, as I'm sure you can see, you have the utmost need of patience and also compassion. The person who is angry with you is actually being extremely kind. Thinking of the particular kindness of your enemy, you can appreciate them from the depths of your heart. And so this is the way the Buddha is appearing to us, in the form of an enemy saying, hey, here's something I bet you're attached to. And then it's an opportunity to work with that attachment. So, going back up there for a moment. Does anyone want to offer some anything that comes to mind? Reflections, questions, comments? Vigorous denial.